This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, cigarette sales went up last year for the first time in decades. We'll look at some of the potential reasons for that increase and what it means for our health. Now, millions of 5 to 11-year-olds in the U.S. can now get vaccinated against COVID-19. That's after the federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention gave the final all clear this week. And limited booster shots for the Moderna and Johnson & Johnson vaccines have been underway for almost 2 weeks in Wisconsin. We're checking in on both of those stories and more with the state's top public health official. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you planning to get your newly eligible 5 to 11-year-old vaccinated? How are you talking to your kids about the vaccine? What questions do you have about the availability of vaccines for kids and booster shots? How it is all working in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Karen Timberlake is the Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Secretary Designee Timberlake, thanks for joining us today.
You are very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Before we dig into those vaccines and how available they are, big picture, can you talk about the state of COVID-19 here in Wisconsin?
Sure. So I think there's sort of a good news story and a reason to stay vigilant, as one of my colleagues said the other day. The good news is, as compared to the real spike in positive cases that we saw earlier this fall, we have seen a bit of a decline in our average case count day after day and week after week. So that's good. That said, the current rate of positive cases is still pretty comparable to what it was back in the sort of early part of the year, back in the winter in January or so, pre really wide-scale rollout of the COVID-19 vaccines. And so we also know that we have to stay vigilant in terms of making sure that everybody who's eligible to get vaccinated gets vaccinated, making sure that folks who are feeling symptomatic or know that they've been exposed to someone with COVID-19 are getting tested so that we can find and address those cases right away. Making sure folks who are not feeling well stay home when they're sick. And now is a good time also to underscore that it is time to get a flu shot, because seasonal influenza will be here before we want it to be. And that also creates a challenge, certainly for our hospitals and our healthcare capacity.
All right, now turning to a vaccine for kids. As I understand it, kids in Wisconsin age 5 to 11 have started getting vaccines today. Can you talk about what you're seeing in the rollout?
Absolutely. So really good news that this week we got the final approval from the CDC for the Pfizer vaccine for kids ages 5 to 11. So this is under an emergency use authorization. I think folks who have been following the rollout of the COVID vaccines in general know that this is kind of the first phase of access to one of the COVID vaccines. Starts under an emergency use authorization from the FDA, which again relies on a great deal of clinical trial data and other careful analysis of both the safety and the effectiveness of the vaccine. So now we have vaccinators all across the state. So that may be our pediatric clinics, that can be some local public health clinics that are partnering with schools. Our pharmacies around the state have announced that they're starting to administer vaccines for kids ages 5 to 11. And so we're adding those points of access for the COVID-19 vaccine for those younger children to what is already available for kids ages 12 and up, and of course, all adults. So it's really a great expansion of the ability of parents and families to protect their younger children ages 5 to 11 from being infected with COVID-19.
And I happened to call a health clinic yesterday for an unrelated reason and got a message saying, yeah, we're getting lots of calls because of this COVID for kids, roll out the booster shots. If people are running into what look like log jams, what do you suggest to them as they're seeking vaccines for those 5 to 11-year-olds?
Yep, great question. And honestly, from a public health perspective, I'm really pleasantly surprised and pleased to hear that you're hearing reports of that kind of demand already. That's really good news. A couple of ways for people to access information about the vaccine. One is to go to vaccines.gov, which continues to be just a great repository of information as far as where the COVID-19 vaccines are available and instructions about how to sign up and make an appointment. Another option, of course, is to check, as you did, with your own healthcare provider. So in the case of parents and family members with younger children, that's your pediatrician's office, that's your family doctor, that's your community health center, if that's where you get your care. They will have information, whether it's over the phone or many of them on their websites, about vaccine availability, how to book an appointment. Another good option for people is the 211 system. So simply calling 211 connects you to a real person who can talk you through how to find out more about where vaccines are available. But, I think as we have learned with the rollout of vaccines all throughout the pandemic, there is a lot of demand early on that can create a little bit of delay. We just would ask for people to be patient and to know that the really good news is that there is enough Pfizer vaccine available for kids ages 5 to 11 across the country. It just will take a little bit of time for those waves of doses to get distributed around the country. So again, vaccine is here in the state and available for those younger kids, and if you don't get the very first appointment time that you're interested in, keep checking, and one will certainly be available.
We're talking to Karen Timberlake, head of the state's Health Services Department, looking at COVID-19 vaccines for kids. We'll get into booster vaccines and public health officials leaving their posts. You can join in with your thoughts or questions on any of those topics at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Heather is with us in Franklin. Heather, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to ask about, Heather?
Well, I know that, and she touched a little bit on it as far as authorization as opposed to approval. Even the 12 to 15-year-olds, it's still in, like, the authorization period. How long does it usually take to get that approval?
Heather, thanks for that call. So, again, that's the emergency use authorization versus the longer process of getting the full approval. What is the kind of time frame that people are watching for?
Right. Maybe the best way I can answer that is let's remember what happened for the COVID vaccines for people ages 16 and up. So when these vaccines first became available back at the end of calendar year 2020, so it was back in December that the first COVID vaccines were actually available, again, for everybody under emergency use authorization. And I want to say that it was in the late summer to maybe very early fall. Don't hold me to that. We can certainly get you the actual date. Mm-hmm. But it was a matter of perhaps 6 to 9 months later that the vaccines moved from emergency use authorization onto that full FDA approval status. And so, I think the thing that's important for people to understand, and what I think really does underlie that really good question, is why do we start with an emergency use authorization as compared to that sort of full FDA approval? And so the thing for people to understand is that there is a great deal of rigorous research and evaluation of these vaccines in the groups of people that they are designed for that occurs long before we even get to this emergency use authorization stage. So what that means is, in the case of the vaccine for kids ages 5 to 11, it has been tested in clinical trials involving tens of thousands of kids ages 5 to 11, and it has been deemed safe and effective in those kids. And so it is viewed as safe and effective enough to be out and available on the market, and there are sort of remaining regulatory processes that need to be gone through to move it from that emergency use authorization over to full approval. But folks really should have confidence in the research and the rigorous safety validation that occurs before any one of these vaccines for any of us even makes it into a pharmacy or a doctor's office.
Heather, thanks for that call. Secretary Timberlake, parents of these 5 to 11-year-olds, I know some are excited to get the vaccine as soon as possible. Others might say, hey, you know, COVID-19, much more dangerous for older people. The rates of bad outcomes for younger people are much, much lower. Not completely safe, of course, but much lower. What is the case for recommending the vaccine, as your department is, for the 5 to 11-year-olds?
Yeah, you bet. So such a great question. And this is really one of the most challenging things about the whole COVID-19 pandemic is that each one of us is making that kind of risk benefit calculation every day with whether we choose to, you know, have a big group of people over together inside our house versus out in the backyard, what kinds of other activities we decide to engage in. And when it comes to the vaccine, you know, I guess I would make a couple of points when it comes to kids ages 5 to 11. First, it is certainly true that younger children in general do not get as sick as older people do when it comes to being exposed to COVID-19. That said, they certainly do get sick. And when they get sick, they can end up missing school and missing other kinds of activities. And one of the things we know for our younger kids is, and frankly, older teens as well, is there's just been a lot of disruption of school and activities, extracurriculars, things that kids really count on as part of their day-to-day, week-to-week experiences. And we want to minimize those disruptions to the greatest extent that we can. We also know that, again, even though most children don't get all that sick, some children do. And we have had more than 1,600 young people under the age of 20, so a little bit broader than just the 5 to 11-year-olds that we're talking about, but 1,600 younger people in hospitals in our state just since March of last year with COVID-19. And for anyone who's had a child with a complex or a serious health condition who has needed hospitalization, that's a terrifying experience for a family and really a scary experience for that child, as good as our hospital care is. So that is something that I think parents want and guardians want to avoid at all costs. And we also know, of course, that kids live in families and in communities, and they are interacting with their aunts and uncles, their grandparents, older adults in their lives. And so kids can also be transmitters of COVID-19. And we want, at the end of the day, we want to protect everyone all across our state from this disease and put this pandemic in the rearview mirror. So all of those things are reasons that we really do recommend, and the American Academy of Pediatrics really recommends, that every child age 5 and up get vaccinated against COVID-19.
We're talking to Karen Timberlake, Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, with us today for a look at COVID-19 vaccines for kids, booster shots, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you getting an appointment for your 5 to 11-year-old? Have you gotten it yet? How about booster shots? Are you seeking one? Have you gotten one? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about the latest on the fight against COVID-19, including vaccines for kids. Secretary Designee Karen Timberlake is with us from the State Department of Health Services. Go back to your calls now with Cindy in Green Bay. Cindy, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My daughter turns 12 in December, early December. Do we get the 11-year-old dose now and get her fully vaccinated? Or do we wait until she turns 12 and get the greater dose?
Yep, that is just a great question, and I know it has come up recently. The clinical guidance is that kids should get the vaccine that is appropriate for the age that they are when they get vaccinated. So for an 11-year-old, they should get the dose, and I believe it's a 1/3 the amount that is given to older kids. So 11-year-olds get that dose today. If that child turns 12 by the time it's 3 weeks later and time for them to get their second dose, then they would get the dose that's suitable for 12-year-olds. So that's what the clinicians are telling us. And so that's what our vaccinators are being instructed to do.
Cindy, good luck figuring that out. Thanks for the call. We'll go next to Mark in Elgin, Illinois. Mark, hi.
Hi. Love the show. And I'm just calling to say I got my booster and I've had no side effects. My own children have equally been vaccinated. I have no concerns. I was mentioning to your screener there also, too, I admire the prowess of Mr. Rogers, the quarterback, but apparently he is not an epidemiologist, and I wish he would have the intelligence to realize that there are certain things he doesn't know, but epidemiologists do.
I got you, Mark. Thanks for the call. That's a whole nother conversation. But he mentioned those booster shots, Secretary Timberlake. Can you talk about the current guidelines for who should be seeking out those boosters or at least thinking about it?
Yep, absolutely. So for people who received the Moderna or the Pfizer vaccine as their primary vaccine, once 6 months have elapsed, there are groups of people who are really strongly encouraged to go ahead and get a booster dose. And it's a long list, but I'll try to be quick. So it's everyone 65 years and older, because we continue to see that that is the age group that is most susceptible to really serious complications and death from COVID-19. Anyone living in a long-term care setting, people who are 18 and older who have a long list of complex or chronic health conditions, cancer, potentially diabetes, HIV infection, even smokers, people whose underlying health status puts them at greater risk. In addition, people over the age of 18 who work in settings where they're interacting all day, every day with members of the general public. So first responders, teachers, people working in manufacturing settings, not so much maybe because of the general public, but because they're working in close quarters with one another, grocery store workers, right? So all of those folks, Pfizer and Moderna, after 6 months, 6 months after completing that primary vaccination series, they would be eligible for boosters and really should go get them. In the case of Johnson & Johnson, it's a little bit simpler. So essentially everyone who got a Johnson & Johnson shot initially should get a booster dose at least 2 months after they got that first Johnson & Johnson dose. And as I'm sure your listeners are following, the advice for people who got Johnson & Johnson is that they can be boosted with Johnson & Johnson, or they could choose to be boosted with a Pfizer or a Moderna vaccine.
Thanks again for the call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Austin next in Barron. Austin, hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I have a question. I have two sons, a 10-year-old and a 12-year-old. And we've always been getting all the vaccines that we're supposed to since they've been born. And my parents are telling us not to get it and to hold off because of the emergency use. They're saying it's not approved yet. And my concern is that if they do have some sort of reaction or something, since it's under the emergency use, is there some sort of recourse as far as if they have, you know, anything that could go wrong with them health-wise? Is Pfizer liable for that? Or since it's an EU approval, does that mean that they're not liable for that?
Austin, thanks for the call. Is that something you've been following, Secretary Timberlake?
Yeah, so I definitely don't feel like I'm ready to give advice on the potential for sort of liability issues. What I can say is that these vaccines have been given now hundreds of millions of times across the country, certainly in the 12 and up age group. And as I noted previously, just really rigorous testing in the younger age group. I think the other thing to remember is that we're talking about the same vaccine, the Pfizer vaccine itself, that has been fully approved for people ages 16 and up. And so, you know, that's also, I think, a good note of reassurance that the safety profile is really strong. And certainly the group of scientific advisors and experts that took a look at the clinical trial data before approving the vaccine for kids 12 to 15 and looked at it for kids 5 to 11. You know, in the case of 5 to 11-year-olds this week, it got a unanimous endorsement from that group of advisors who are really studying the data. And the last thing to say on that question is, certainly parents and guardians and family members are going to have questions about the vaccine. And the best place to start is with your own care provider, your family doctor, your child's pediatrician. You know, call them up and have a conversation about what makes sense for your child and your family.
Thanks for that call. I want to take a couple minutes before we let you go to check out another issue I'm sure you're paying attention to. A lot of public health turnover, local health departments losing their leadership, high stress year and a half here, a lot of public pressure in some cases. What do you make of that level of turnover and the impact it could have?
So what I want to say, first of all, is we throughout the course of this pandemic have just relied so heavily on our local public health departments, our public health directors, their staff, to be on the front lines of the response to the COVID-19 pandemic. And, you know, folks may not really understand what local public health departments have been doing when it comes to COVID-19. So these are the folks, you know, when there are cases that break out in a place of employment or a school or a long-term care setting, they're going in to do the investigations, do the contact tracing, see what they can do to contain the outbreak right away. They are doing a lot of proactive consulting with employers and schools to make sure people can be safe. They're running vaccination clinics and community testing programs. And that's on top of doing everything that they do all across our state to keep our restaurants and our food supply safe, make sure we've got good water quality, good air quality. So a huge part of our ability to be healthy and safe in everything we do in Wisconsin relies on our local public health leaders. So we owe them just a huge thank you. It has been a stressful year. We are certainly wanting to make sure that we continue to provide the kind of investment in resources that we know our local public health leaders need. Governor Evers has announced about $58 million in funding to continue to infuse into local public health departments on top of about $106 million that was previously allocated. So at the end of the day, you know, I think we all need to, as people have noted, give each other some patience and some grace and recognize that we really are all in this together and working together, doing the best that we can to keep one another safe. We will get through this pandemic.
Secretary Timberlake, thanks again for joining us today.
You are very welcome.
That's Karen Timberlake, Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. She was with us today to talk about the rollout of vaccines for 5 to 11-year-olds here in the state, along with the latest on booster shots and more. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, Wisconsin's Attorney General Josh Call joins the program for a look at election review efforts, redistricting, and other legal issues facing Wisconsin. And as always, you can join in with your own questions and comments for the state's attorney general. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Milwaukee could go all the way in an online competition to pick the best city in the United States. The competition is about as scientific as it gets. It's a bracket tournament on Twitter set up by some guy on the internet, an urban planning expert named Nolan Gray. 64 cities started off the bracket. Milwaukee has been on a winning streak. As reported in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, voters selected number 10 seed Milwaukee over number 7 Austin, Texas in the opening round. Since then, Milwaukee has beaten Miami, San Francisco, and Minneapolis. That led to an I-94 showdown with Chicago in the semifinals. Milwaukee narrowly pulled out the win. And now start spreading the news because Milwaukee is in the finals against New York City.
New York City.
Hey, if we can make it there, we can make it anywhere. You can find the poll at the Twitter handle at MNolanGray. Looks like voting hasn't started yet. First the Bucks, now this. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network, I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, President Biden says vaccines for kids will be up and running by next week. The CDC just authorized Pfizer's vaccine for kids as young as 5. It's an announcement some parents have been waiting for. Others don't know how to handle. Get answers to your questions about kids and the shot. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, a new report from the Federal Trade Commission shows that cigarette sales increased in 2020 by $800 million. It's the first time in 20 years that sales have gone up from the previous year. The latest findings also include new data on flavors, especially menthol, and smokeless tobacco products. So did the pandemic drive some of us to smoke? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you or someone in your life a smoker? Have you quit a long time ago or recently? Has the pandemic influenced you or someone you know's tobacco use? Are you seeing more people smoking in your area? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Doug Jorenby is the Director of Clinical Services for the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. He's a professor of medicine for the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Jorenby, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me back.
Well, years, 20 or so years of declines in cigarette sales. Were you surprised to see this uptick?
It certainly stands out in the curve of consumption over, as you said, the last two decades. At the same time, I think we have to take it with a grain of salt, given that it was less than half a percentage point of an increase. And of course, the circumstances around pretty much everything in 2020 were extraordinary in all the senses of that term. But it's definitely something that bears close attention in the coming year.
Right. Not a huge increase, but up when you'd prefer to see continued down. Could you talk about some of the circumstances of the pandemic that may have slowed the decline in our smoking rates?
Sure. And, you know, it's important to note that the Federal Trade Commission is just looking at the number of cigarettes sold. That's what they're talking about. But it does not take a whole lot of imagination to look at, I think, two factors that are very relevant to all of that. One, of course, for just about everybody, 2020 was a remarkably stressful and disruptive year. And of course, if there's one thing that we know about people who regularly use tobacco products, cigarettes or smokeless, for a lot of them, it's their go-to when they're coping with stress. And there was more than enough stress to go around in 2020. So the idea that intake, that use would go up during those extraordinary circumstances of the pandemic is not surprising. The other factor, too, is with a lot of people working from home, you know, the various closing of public places, which are almost universally smoke-free environments, a lot of people were spending much more time at home where, you know, unless they chose to have restrictions on it, there really weren't limits on smoking in particular, where environmental tobacco smoke is a concern. So again, another factor that may well have led people who were already using cigarettes and other tobacco to increase their consumption in 2020.
I should flip things around and look at the 20 years of good news, declining use of tobacco products. What's behind some of that success story?
Well, I think it's a combination of a number of things. Big one being that we have effective ways to help people quit smoking. It's no longer just, you know, when years ago when I started doing this, really the only option people had was throw away your cigarettes and tough it out cold turkey, especially for that first week, which is when the vast majority of people would go back to smoking. We now have effective evidence-based treatments. They reduce withdrawal, they reduce the craving, they make it much less unpleasant for people than quitting cold turkey. There's also, though, been a lot of social changes that have augmented that, in that there are so many environments now where smoking in particular, less so for smokeless tobacco, but smoking is not allowed to protect the health of people in the environment. And of course, the social perspective on smoking has changed too, from something that was incredibly commonplace. It was not that long ago that it wasn't uncommon to have healthcare workers in clinics and hospitals lighting up right there. And these days, that's basically inconceivable. And we've also had an increase in effective prevention programs too. And I think you really see that in terms of young people choosing not to start using tobacco in the first place.
That strikes me. I was in the hospital once when I was in high school, and I had to be moved out of my hospital room because my roommate was smoking, the person in the other bed in the room.
Wow.
You don't see that anymore, do you?
No, not at all. And, you know, it seems like a long time ago, but it was only the mid-1990s. No, and didn't mean to imply, but yeah, from a policy point of view, it was only the mid 1990s that the Joint Commission on Healthcare Facilities actually came out and said hospitals and clinics really need to be smoke free. Otherwise, we're sending a very negative mixed message to people who are seeking to improve their health.
Talking to Dr. Doug Jorenby with the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, looking at tobacco rates, tobacco use rates in the U.S. going down for 20 years, an uptick in cigarette sales this last year, though. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Barry is with us now in Madison. Barry, hi.
Hi, Dr. Jorenby. Hi, I remember you from the UW, Tobacco Research Center. I quit again with the patch, 21 milligram, and I had to cut a sock in half and put it on my shoulder to hold it on, and I'm dealing with a lot of stress. And I was wondering, what's the best way to handle stress?
Interesting. Thanks, Barry. So he's got the patch, which is all with the nicotine side of thing. But how about that stress? That's part of the solution, right, Dr. Jorenby?
Absolutely. Yeah. And, of course, it varies from person to person what that stress is coming from and what kind of things people have to deal with it. But, great creative problem solving there, Barry, with the sock. I love that one. I'll have to file that away for future reference. The big thing is, there are a lot of different things that people use to help them cope with stress, whether it's leaving situations, whether it's doing some deep breathing to calm themselves down if they're feeling really anxious, whether it's taking action to address the cause of the stress rather than just keeping it at bay at the length of a cigarette. The important thing, I think, for people to remember to take away from that is that they don't have to be helpless in the face of stress if they stop smoking. People who have never smoked do all kinds of things to deal with stress on a regular basis. It's just for a lot of people who start smoking, particularly as teenagers, it's just been so convenient. It's a go-to, and they've never really had the opportunity to learn some of the other stress coping techniques that people who have never smoked use all the time.
Thanks a lot for that call, Barry. We'll go now to Lissy in Green Bay. Lissy, hi.
Hi. Thank you, Rob, and thank you to your guests for being on today. I just wanted to say I've been a smoker since high school, unfortunately, and my schedule didn't really change too much over COVID, but I will say my smoking definitely increased, whether it was out of just, everybody else's things going on or, the stress levels or just clearly out of boredom.
Okay, and I'm guessing not alone, Dr. Jorenby, smoking more just because of that, the weird year, the boredom and the stress.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, and that's something I should have mentioned up front. But yeah, boredom actually can be a major source of stress for people, and again, it's a go-to for a lot of people. That's a cue to pick up a cigarette and start puffing away when you feel bored, even though we don't always necessarily think of it as being stressful in the same way. But, certainly there was plenty of boredom to go along with things too, when people couldn't go to their, their typical restaurant or the bar or to go out to see a movie, all the other things that we use to distract ourselves from feeling bored in normal circumstances.
Thanks for that call and good luck to you, Lissy. We're talking to Dr. Doug Jorenby from the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, looking at an uptick in cigarette sales over the last year after 20 years of going down. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've got a question or experience you'd like to share, that's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation and get a look at a local prevention effort here in Wisconsin that's coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about tobacco use during the pandemic. Dr. Doug Jorenby is with us, Director of Clinical Services for the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. Now we're going to take a closer look at a local prevention effort in Milwaukee. Lorraine Lathan is the founder and president of Jump at the Sun Consultants, an organization that administers the Wisconsin African American Tobacco Prevention and Poverty Network. Lorraine, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Can you talk about tobacco as an issue of special concern in Milwaukee, especially among Black and low-income communities?
Yes, I can. Just wanted to kind of share with you that we know that tobacco is an addiction, and we know that there are tobacco disparities. When you look at African Americans, when you look at people, low-income populations, the rate of tobacco use is much higher. In fact, for African Americans, it's almost twice that of the state average. It's at 25%, whereas the state is at 16%. And clearly with the pandemic, there's been lots of stressors that have triggered even more tobacco use within the communities that we serve. So what we've done is we've really tried to encourage people who have quit to stay quit. And part of that is looking at what their triggers are and having a plan of action of how to deal with those triggers. It could be exercise, it could be not hanging out with others that smoke, not hanging out at bars, but really having a plan to deal with triggers. So that's one of the things that we've been doing. The way we function is we work with and for the community. We do quite a bit of work in public housing and with residents in general. So we have subcommittees that have focused on helping people, educating people around tobacco and knowing that tobacco is the cause of the three leading causes of deaths for African Americans, which is heart disease, cancer, and stroke. So we want people to know that. We want people to have the tools to be able to quit smoking, at least to initiate that quit journey. And some of the things we've had to do with the pandemic is we've had to provide support virtually via Zoom versus in person. We recently will be launching a campaign that deals with COVID and smoking and how COVID actually it's a good time to quit smoking because of the pandemic. And so that campaign has been developed by Public Housing Residents. It's a social media campaign to provide people with support so that they can quit smoking. Those are just a few of the activities that we're engaged in. We have worked very hard to address the issue of menthol. Mm-hmm. We know that mentholated tobacco products, they're easier to start and more difficult to quit. And they're smoked more often by African-Americans and or people, low-income populations. And so we've done a lot around educating around menthol. We know young people that they certainly had become addicted to mentholated tobacco products. So we've been working with our faith-based partners. We have No Menthol Sunday, which is nationwide, where we have our pastors really just sharing from the pulpit the harms of tobacco, the harms of menthol, and a number of activities that occur. Now, we started that years ago in Milwaukee. It has expanded throughout the state of Wisconsin, so we're pleased to be part of that movement to educate. And I guess the only other thing I'd want to share with you, with, again, going back to the pandemic, when you look at some of the communities where you see tobacco addiction at much higher rates than the general population, we started to notice a few things. We started to notice that there are more tobacco retailers in those communities, sometimes two times as many more retailers, and sometimes depending on the zip code or the census tract, could be as many as three to five times more retailers. And we also noticed that there's more tobacco retailers within 500 feet of schools, playgrounds, and youth serving organizations. So we've been working with our community to mobilize them to educate on these are also triggers as well. You know, if you're trying to stop and you're seeing advertising all over the place, when you go to pay for gas, when you run to the convenience store and the advertising for tobacco is prominently displayed and you're trying to quit, that creates barriers. So our network is working with the community to try to change some of even just the zoning around the advertising that is occurring, price promotions that occur more often in our communities than in the suburbs as well. So this is just a few kind of examples of the work that we've been doing. And we certainly, when the pandemic started, we called some of the people that had gone through some of the smoking cessation programs that we have supported. We called them, we did kind of wellness phone calls to just say, okay, how are you doing? How's your quitting journey? How is that working for you? Do you think you need to modify your plan, in terms of how to deal with triggers? So a lot of just trying to provide support and outreach. And we always encourage people when they feel they're gonna relapse to call 1-800-QUIT-NOW, which is our state quit line number, which also provides quit aids as well.
And Lorraine, I wanted to ask you, you've got this community focused approach, as you mentioned, reaching out personally to people. If there are people around the state who think, yeah, we see a lot of smoking here, what would you suggest to them, just in our last minute with you, to start up a program like that on their own?
Yes. So I would suggest that they reach out to us. They can contact us at waatpn.org. And we can certainly support them. We have all kinds of materials. And it can start, I would encourage people even to start with a small group, and they can grow that group. It's all about supporting one another as they're trying to quit. So we have the tools, we have the information. They are welcome to reach out to us.
Lorraine, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
That's Lorraine Lathan. She administers the Wisconsin African American Tobacco Prevention and Poverty Network through her organization Jump at the Suns Consultants. Let's bring Dr. Doug Jornby back into the conversation now. A lot there to follow up on, Dr. Jornby. First of all, the value of a local community-based effort like she was telling us about.
Yeah, absolutely. And Ms. Lathan and her team have just done some really important work over the years, making use of those personal community connections. And particularly for people who historically haven't had good access to quality health care, that's absolutely critical in overcoming disparities, because we know, as she mentioned, that tobacco use is not an equal opportunity dependence. It really hits hardest at the people that have the least income, the least education, the least opportunity.
She also mentioned the menthol cigarette issue, which I know the Federal Trade Commission has started tracking the numbers of menthol cigarette sales. How big a part of the story is that?
I think it's an increasing one, and it was very interesting to see the emphasis that the Federal Trade Commission placed on menthol. It's kind of going in parallel with what we see the Food and Drug Administration doing with vaping products, where they've signaled very strongly that flavors of any kind, with the possible exception of menthol, are just going to be complete non-starters because of the evidence that's amassed with vaping and e-cigarettes, how appealing those are to young people and get them started in using nicotine that often goes on to tobacco. So I think it's not a coincidence that the emphasis you mentioned was there. And that also spills over into some novel products like nicotine pouches that don't contain tobacco at all, but is something that the FDA is going to have to come to grips with as they move into the market in the U.S.
And the issue of advertising, especially concentrated in higher risk communities, and the concentration of retailers in at-risk communities. Do you think steps need to be taken to deal with those?
I think the numbers that Ms. Lathan mentioned just speak for themselves. It's just when you stop to look at the prevalence of vending outlets and advertising and proximity to schools in low-income neighborhoods versus more affluent neighborhoods, it just jumps out at you. It's a far more significant change than the less than a percentage point increase in uptake we were talking about earlier. And I think it's something, as communities become more aware of it, they realize that that this is a deliberate strategy that's being followed and not necessarily one that they they need to go along with.
And for people, Dr. Jordan B., who are still smoking and want to quit, or maybe even saw that uptick or going back to smoking during the pandemic, what kind of resources do we have here in Wisconsin to help them out?
We have a great one, which is the Wisconsin Tobacco Quit Line. It's available at no cost to anyone in the state. Folks can access that through the web or by calling 1-800-QUITNOW, Quit Now. And they provide counseling through the telephone, through texts. They also can provide people with up to 2 weeks of over-the-counter nicotine replacement therapy like patches or lozenges or gum, as we were talking about earlier, that help reduce withdrawal and craving and can increase people's chances of quitting successfully on the order of 2 to 3 times when you combine those factors.
And just briefly, Dr. Jaronby, I think it's something to emphasize. You hear from people who tried once to quit, it didn't take, and they feel like, well, I can't do it. It's very common that it takes more than one try, right?
It's extremely common, and what we find is people learn. They learn from their experience, and they get better at quitting. So, yes, if someone's tried, not been totally successful, take what you learned from that last attempt and bring that forward into the next time. There are better and worse times, but there's never a bad time to quit tobacco.
Dr. Jaronby, thanks again for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
That's Dr. Doug Jaronby, Director of Clinical Services at the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention and Professor of Medicine at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Join us for a look at the impact of the pandemic on cigarette sales and tobacco use. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's this week's edition of Food Friday, and Dori Greenspan is going to be back with us. She's got a new book, cookbook, full of great baking advice. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll find out how Wisconsin residents feel about Governor Evers, Senator Johnson, and President Biden, and on a bunch of issues that are in the news right now. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.